From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So it turns out pirates, real pirates from the 18th century, may actually have said "arr" from time to time. The journalist and historian Colin Woodard says it wasn't really a pirate thing. It was an expression that came from the West Country of England. It's an affirmation like, yeah. And a lot of pirates were English, so it makes sense you'd hear "arr" on a pirate ship. But the "shiver me timbers" or "avast ye," probably not so much. That came from Hollywood. Today in the program, Woodard is joining us to separate the reality of pirate life from the legend. There are some great stories here with some great characters. The Golden Age of Pirates didn't last all that long, but it had a surprisingly powerful effect on the idea of democracy. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. You can donate $10 right now by texting KUER to 85944. That's KUER to 85944. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's so much that's interesting about pirates, and we all have our images of pirate life, and most of it comes from the popular culture we've consumed, which leaves us with these bedraggled men in eye patches and tattered bandanas snarling and clutching daggers in their teeth. But like everything, the real story is more complicated, and the real characters are much more interesting than the legends. The Golden Age of Pirates didn't actually last all that long, about 10 years, but pirate culture, if you can put it that way, was remarkably complex and civilized. These men and some women established a pirate republic, which welcomed pretty much anyone, the grunts on merchant vessels, indentured servants, runaway slaves. They were equal citizens in this community. They had councils. They voted. And this part may be as interesting as the peg legs and the piles of treasure, because the historian and journalist Colin Woodard says that pirates helped fan the flames of democracy, the ideas that came to influence the American Revolution. Today in the program, we're talking about pirates. Colin Woodard is a journalist and a writer. He's a reporter for the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram. Among the books he's written is The Republic of Pirates. And Colin Woodard is joining us today from a studio in Portland, Maine. And Colin Woodard, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks much. It's a pleasure.
I want to start with a story you tell in the book about when you first, at least as I understand it, when you first considered writing a book about pirates. And the setting, I have to say, seemed kind of perfect. You were sitting under a palm tree?
Yes, in Belize on an offshore island.
How did it work? And, what was the story? Yeah, tell about it.
Well, I was thinking quite a bit about what my new book project would be about. And to be honest, my interest initially in pirates was a little exploitative. I'm a great believer that the colonial period of American history is very poorly understood and that many of the answers about, you know, who we are as a people and American identity and the roots of a lot of our current polarization all tie back to that poorly understood time. So I was looking for a way at the time to pull a mass audience into the colonial era so they would embrace it and try to understand it, and you could draw them in. You know, I was trying to figure out how you would go about that. It was on the beach in Belize with a woman who would later be my wife, who we were looking out, and I was just thinking and daydreaming about what the pirates must have been like. You know, what were those people? You know, you could see the vision of the sailing ship and almost, you know, smell the twine and the pitch and see them. But what were they like? What were they doing out there? And it struck me, you know, that's perfect. There's the vehicle I can use. Everyone's interested in pirates and I can draw the audience in that way. But as I started actually researching the story of who this Golden Age pirate gang really were, this pirate gang that's responsible for probably 90% of all our pop imagery, it was entirely unexpected itself. And the story was so incredible that I guess you could say I was hooked. So I was planning on using the pirates and they captured me and drew my own attention.
What do you – when you see you know, films, when you see the TV shows, the sort of the sketches And you get that impression that we all had that I mentioned, you know, the args and the peg legs and all that kind of thing. What do you think about that? I mean, what is the popular impression, the part that we get right and the part we get that we get wrong? I mean, we'll talk about this in detail as we go, but the general sense that most of us have of pirates, what do you figure that is?
Well, there's this impulse, right, that makes the pirates attractive is the impulse in many of us that, you know, gosh, if I could just throw off all the constraints of society and going to work today and fighting traffic and everything else, I could fantasize and daydream about just, you know, driving the car out to sea and starting your own live life on your own terms and, you know, merrily charge forth and be free of encumbrances and live by your own wits. There's something in that impulse that I think a lot of people feel. That part, why is it that we connect that with these particular pirates? That part actually rings true. It's mm-hmm. just that the reasons for it, the reasons that pirates are folk heroes for us now is they were folk heroes at the time they were operating amongst yeah. large numbers of ordinary people. And that has stuck with us ever since, even as the story of the pirates and why we associate them with those sort of impulses has been forgotten.
I was surprised how short the golden age of piracy was. 10 years.
Yeah, 10 years optimistically. And yeah. the real sort of crux of it was really a 5-year period or even shorter. It was a very brief period of time and it was involving essentially one gang of pirates who all knew each other or by one degree of separation knew each other and had served with one another on merchant vessels and naval vessels and privateering vessels. Privateers are sort of mercenaries. They're given permission by their sovereign to attack enemy shipping in time of war. And they were all involved and they were all operating out of a shared base in the Bahamas Islands, which mm-hmm. was a failed colony. And incredibly, they're responsible for virtually all of our pirate iconography now, and not surprising, many of the members of the great pantheon of pirates were in this gang. Blackbeard, Sam Bellamy of widow fame, the gentleman pirate Stede Bonnet, the women pirates Mary Read and Anne Bonny, this bombastic Charles Vane and Calico Jack Rackham, and so on. So it was an incredibly unusual pirate gang, both in the degree of success they had and in their motivations.
But you do point out also in the book that pirates have existed for a long time in human history. There were pirates in ancient Greece, in the Roman Empire, even in ancient China.
Yeah, thousands of years. Some say it's the second oldest profession. And the pirates have been around all of that time. And you know, many people ask the question, you know, aren't these guys were criminals and terrorists, and how can they be celebrated as these sort of anti-heroes? And I think it's true that most pirates in history before and since this pirate gang have been largely, you know, undesirable characteristics and exceedingly dangerous and unscrupulous and violent and unethical and murderous and all those things that we sometimes associate with pirates. This particular gang, though, was a bit different. Mm-hmm. I mean, they saw themselves as not being just ordinary bandits, but being involved in a sort of social revolt against the ship captains and ship owners and an increasingly tyrannical aristocratic system that was forming in the British Empire that had made their lives miserable as ordinary sailors and who were making the lives of many common people exceedingly difficult and precarious. And so you could see it in many respects. They would seize control of a vessel either by mutiny or by capture, and the first thing they would do is turn the government of the ship upside down. You know, the naval ships of the age and merchant ships were ruled in a top-down hierarchy enforced by brutal discipline. The pirates, by contrast, elected their captains by a show of hand. They could depose their captains at any time they wanted outside of combat by a show of hands. They would elect another official, a quartermaster, whose job responsibilities included keeping tabs on the captain and reporting back to the crew. And the captain wasn't allowed to have his own captain on most vessels, his own cabin on most vessels, yeah. but rather had to share them. And they shared their plunder almost entirely equally, whereas, say, on a privateering vessel, you know, the investors would get half of the plunder that you collected by attacking enemy shipping in time of war, and your captain would get 14 shares, and maybe you'd get one. On pirate vessels, the captain might get 1.5 shares, and everyone else would get one. So it was an entirely different and for the time period, radical way of reorganizing things and governing the ship that to some extent carried forth on land as well.
Yeah, radically different. Dictators and monarchs, that's what was going on in the world at the time. And even
Absolutely.
On ships, they were tyrants, you know, they were dictators.
And remember, they're operating largely in the Caribbean and West Indies, and this is at a time at the height of the most brutal of the slave plantation societies of the Sugar Islands and the Carolinas, the most tyrannical places you could possibly imagine. And here are the pirates conducting themselves in this way. And it's that's the interesting window. This is six decades before the American Revolution, and we rarely see what ordinary people were thinking and feeling about these big issues, because they tended not to write down their thoughts, and their writings, if they existed, rarely survived to today. But here's this window where generations before the ideas of 1776 or the French Revolution in 1789 have happened, you're seeing these people obviously angry at the system itself and reorganizing it in a radical and brutish kind of democratic way that frightened people but was revolutionary in its own way. And the most interesting thing of all is that ordinary people in large numbers seem to support and embrace the pirates' view of things, that they were Robin Hood's men that were sort of righting injustices.
I wonder, I wonder if you've ever fantasized this idea that somewhere down the line someone's going to find some writings of Thomas Jefferson where he not only talks about, the influence of Locke or someone like that, but there's a reference to like Benjamin Hornigold or Blackbeard. Do you know what I mean? Like there's some actual evidence of the fact that the founding fathers were influenced by these pirate societies.
Anything's possible, but I very much doubt that the founding fathers or that the American Revolution was actually literally informed by the pirate experience. But I think a lot of the emotions and stuff that drove things like the Boston Tea Party and many of those other events had been developing for a long time, that many ordinary people were upset about the increasingly autocratic nature of the British imperial system and the way land was being reallocated and so on and so forth. And you can see it in the pirates, and you can see it in many of the subsequent disturbances between that period and the American Revolution. Oftentimes when there'd be a riot or a protest, you'd find that sailors would be at the vanguard of many of these actions, that in the maritime community they seem to be sort of the shock troops of resistance. And I think that ties into the pirate era as well, that the pirates were almost entirely former mariners, and that within that universe you already had these kinds of revolutionary sentiments percolating for a very, very long time. So I'd say that the founding fathers were building their project on something that had some of its foundation stones with the pirates and other sailors.
You mentioned in your book, you've written about the fact that there were all kinds of nationalities and races that plugged into these pirate gangs. That was one of the things that was appealing about it. You had Native Americans, and you had Scots, and you had Swedes, and you had all these kinds of people. But I want to back up a little bit, because you tell the story in your book, The Republic of Pirates, about some of the British, some of the English origins of two men in particular, because I think they inform sort of the lives of pirates. One was Samuel Bellamy, Black Sam, the pirate you mentioned. We don't know much, you say, about the early lives of these pirates. History has little to say about them before they became, famous pirates. But Samuel Bellamy, he comes from rural England. Charles Vane, another one. We don't know much about him, but we have a sense that he may have come from the chaos of London at the time. Talk about what life would have been like, because this was intriguing to me, because it sounded miserable in many ways, especially in London, but in rural England at the time, the sort of conditions that Charles Vane and Samuel Bellamy were coming from.
Yeah, there were a lot of push factors that drove people first to go to sea. And remember, writers at the time were writing that being a sailor was much like going to prison, except with the added possibility of drowning.
Right.
It was not something you wanted to do, but a lot of people were were pushed into it and then later pushed into piracy. And some of those push factors were the increasing vulnerability of large numbers of ordinary and, you know, people on the lower end of the socioeconomic ladder in England at the time. You know, in the background for this whole century preceding the piracy outbreak, that, you know, the Middle Ages were coming to an end, and one of the long processes that was happening was that large landowners were liquidating and ending the sort of 100-year leases they gave to their serfs for their serfs' land and huts and stuff, because it was more profitable for them to make all those lands into gigantic fields to grow crops commercially and to grow – or to grow sheep and bring the wool to the woolen mills that were expanding. So you suddenly didn't need all these serfs on the land. So they were taking the land and ending the leases as they came up, and all the serfs and rural population were had nowhere to go. And you had the roads being choked by people streaming into London and the beginnings of the sort of tenements and chaos of the age. And the rule of law was extremely brutal to, you know, there's all sorts of accounts of people, you know, children being put to death for stealing a loaf of bread, and orphans were being taken from orphanages and leased to chimney sweepers. So they would take, you know, 7 or 8 year old kids and have them clean the chimneys from the inside. Yeah. And the mortality rate was extremely high. So it was an incredibly violent time. And when people ended up at sea, sometimes being forced to go to sea with the Royal Navy, say in time of war, being grabbed by a press gang and dragged out to sea. But even if they signed up, that ended up being incredibly dangerous, and you were paid poorly and the food was poor. And during this particular time period leading up to the piracy outbreak, there had been a colonial war, the War of the Spanish Succession, mm-hmm. which is forgotten now. But that had ended just before this piracy outbreak. Right. And it wasn't a coincidence, because with the end of that war, the Royal Navy contracted the size of its fleet by 2/3 and put all the sailors out of work and sort of dumped them in the docks of the empire. And all the privateering commissions that had been given out to would-be mercenaries to attack enemy shipping were withdrawn because the war was over. And suddenly all those people who made a living essentially being legalized pirates had no form of living and a certain set of job skills. Mm-hmm. And finally, those who were still in the merchant trade, there were so many supply and demand in the labor market. There was so many people looking for work that wages dropped by half to almost starvation levels. Mm-hmm. And even if you got paid, you know, you'd have these incredibly dangerous trips and half the crew died in some types of sailing vessels. And even if you survived, you might arrive back at port and discover that you're being paid in Jamaican pounds instead of English pounds, which are worth half as much. But, you know, the contract didn't specify, you know, they were being constantly tricked out of their wages. Yeah. So the precariousness of life was quite extreme, and the violence of ordinary society was of a scale that would shock today. And the conditions on merchant and naval vessels were extremely bad. So there were a lot of people with a lot of grievances towards the way things were happening, particularly at sea.
Which brings us to the summer of 1713 and a compelling character you write about, Benjamin Hornigold, who suggests to his friends and his drinking buddies, you say, you know, the war is just over. As you said, there are all these sort of destitute mariners sort of hanging around on the docks. And what does he suggest? Let's essentially go back to war. Let's go back to the sea. Let's do it ourselves.
Right. A lot of people were starting to freelance piracy or privateering. They'd leave from places like Jamaica and keep attacking the enemy, the Spanish's vessels. And the Spanish were doing the same thing. There were all these Spanish coast guards, they called them, but they were really preying on English ships, you know, claiming that if there were a single Spanish peso found on board, that they were smugglers and they would drag them off to jail. So there was this sort of Cold War going on after mm-hmm. the Hot War. And what Hornigold appears to have suggested is, why don't we go and set ourselves up with a proper base of operations? And there was a perfect location available. You ask yourselves, how did this particular gang of pirates grow to be so formidable as to threaten the commerce of three empires and start occupying outlying colonies and having the Royal Navy on the run, which they did? Well, the reason is that they had this base of operations in the Bahama Islands.
Yeah.
And during the war, the English colony in the Bahamas had been sacked by the enemy twice. And essentially, it was a failed colony. Those people who hadn't fled were out living in the jungle so they could hide out if there were another attack. And Hornigold and his gang moved in before the imperial authorities got around to it. They're the ones who ended up shoring up the fort and making themselves very difficult to actually remove. They created a sustaining base where you could market your goods and do repairs and have rest and recuperation and have the sort of support that you would need to actually sustain yourselves. Because individual vessels out there with no port of call and nowhere to market their goods or buy the supplies they need would be extremely vulnerable. This group of pirates had a whole failed state, rogue state to operate out of. And it was one that was sitting right on the curb of the major highway of the day, the major sea lane leading back to Europe from much of the Caribbean, because remember, this is the age of sail. Mm-hmm. And because of the direction of the prevailing winds, most vessels were compelled to sail through the Straits of Florida, Florida on your left flank, the Bahama Islands on the right flank, and the pirates were in the Bahamas, and Florida was essentially unoccupied by Europeans other than one or two settlements. And they could just jump out and attack vessels and drag them back into this maze of islands that were poorly charted, and they were operating first from canoes that drew very little water and they could go over reefs. And if there were a vessel pursuing them, the vessel couldn't go over the reef as well. They'd run aground, so they could escape very easily into one of 100 hiding places. So it was a perfect base of operations. And that seems to have been the – Hornigold was the person who first set up there with a gang of pirates who may have included Blackbeard. And it seems to be his vision that, hey, we could make this work, this hub. And indeed, it did come to pass.
You say that in the book, the authorities sort of made them out to be these cruel and dangerous, you know, monsters, rapists and murderers. But I want you to talk a little bit about that because you kind of dispel this idea. You talk about that in many ways they mostly existed on what you describe in the book, the value of terror. And there are a couple of stories here. One I wanted you to tell involves Black Sam, Samuel Bellamy. And Bellamy had – there's the story where he has his men – row toward these ships in these canoes, or maybe they were dories, I'm not sure, but they were stripped naked. Talk a little bit about that, because this is a lesson you say he learned in terms of the value of terror, that fear is one of the powerful weapons here.
Yeah, this is the remarkable thing about these particular pirates, particularly when you understand the context of the times and what was going on in London and in the courts of Britain, were remarkably unviolent. They rarely ended up hurting anybody. I mean, all the accounts we have of their activities come from their victims. So they're very credible witnesses. And if you go through them, there are very few times when they're actually killing anybody. They're scaring people. Blackbeard doesn't kill anybody in his entire career until his last fatal battle with the sailors of the Royal Navy, in which he's killed. So they were cultivating these image of terror. And Sam Bellamy in that situation you describe is very much so. They're operating out of these very large ocean-going sailing canoes that could carry like 30 men, and they would they could paddle them straight into the wind. And in certain wind conditions, that meant you could overtake a sailing vessel. And they appeared to be trying to present themselves as, you know, dangerous, wild, you know, men of the forest who come and who knows what they'll do. Maybe they'll eat you, you know, so that people would surrender. And Blackbeard developed this image of terror even further and more self-consciously, in that he would light these lit fuses that he would put into his beard when he went into battle. So there's flame and sparks and smoke floating above him. And remember, he and all his pirates are dressed in they would tend to take the clothing of the wealthy passengers of the vessels they captured, you know, men's periwigs and silk garments and ladies' dresses and umbrellas and who knows what, and, you know, velvet gloves. And they would put them on in this hodgepodge. And at the same time, they're carrying boarding axes and, you know, pistols and grenades and all, you know, the salt of the earth, you know, grizzled guys. It was a really scary image for people. You know, it's sort of a Mad Max under the Thunderdome kind of environment. You have this demon-like apparition up front with fire coming out of his beard, and they're all coming down upon your merchant vessel, and there's, you know, 150 of them, and you're you turn to the victim vessel, the vessel that's going to be captured, and it's, you know, a merchant vessel. There's probably 12 guys on board. They don't own the cargo. Yeah. They're being underpaid and probably fed terrible food and maybe given Jamaican pounds or beaten up by their captain? Are they gonna die facing off against these guys to protect the cargo of a ship owner they don't even know? No way. They're gonna surrender without firing a shot, which was the whole point of what Blackbeard and Bellamy were doing, because they don't want to damage the vessel. They want to capture the vessel. Maybe they can use it to be a pirate ship. They don't want to damage the cargo. They don't want to run the risk of their own vessel being damaged. Say a lucky shot took out one of their masts. They don't have a shipyard to go to replace a main mast. They could be incredibly vulnerable. And most importantly, they don't want to hurt any of the crew of the vessel they're capturing, because the piracy outbreak expanded in the number of pirates very dramatically. Where were all these people coming from? Well, many of them were volunteers. They would capture a vessel and a certain portion of the crew of the captured vessel would take one look at their lot eating terrible food and being beaten up by their captain and paid in Jamaican pounds. And then they'd look at the pirates coming on over with their wealthy clothes and breaking open the barrels of the owner's Madeira and having a great time. They're like, hey, I'm coming with you. So the last thing that Blackbeard or Bellamy wanted to do was harm any of the crew either. So it was the perfect arrangement. Cultivate an image of terror so that everyone is so frightened that you never have to fight anybody. And by and large, to one degree or another, most of these pirates conducted themselves in that way. Now, there were a few psychopaths among them.
Sure.
But largely, it's incredible how unviolent they were, particularly if you look back at the earlier generations of buccaneers and privateers. People like Sir Henry Morgan would think nothing of going to a Spanish city and killing every single person they encountered just for kicks. And he was made governor, and that's why he's Sir Henry Morgan. He was rewarded for what he did. So by comparison, these pirates are remarkable in their restraint of the way they're using force and how clever they were thinking through what their real interests were.
Colin Woodard is joining us. He is the author of the book, The Republic of Pirates. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about pirates, not the modern-day kind, but the pirates of legend, the eye patches and the peg legs, those kind of pirates. Our guest is the writer, the journalist Colin Woodard, joining us to explain just how much of that legend is true, because the true part is even more interesting. These weren't just thugs. They had an order to their lives and a culture and a sense of camaraderie. And in an age of monarchs and tyrants, they were as interested in social upheaval as plunder, though the plunder was pretty important too. Colin Woodard's book is called The Republic of Pirates. So I wanted to ask you a couple of sort of gee whiz questions, which I'm sure you get all of the time. You mentioned that in your book that, and we talked a little bit about the fact that pirates were all kinds of nationalities, Dutch and African and Swedish and Native American, but a lot were English or Irish, which did make me wonder what a pirate would have sounded like. And we all know the pirate accent from the movies, the arg and that kind of thing. Did they have their own kind of lingo, or was it just the lingo of the sea? I mean, do we have any sense of what a pirate sounded like in that way?
We don't have a really, really good sense. I mean, of course, there were no recordings around, and the pirates, by and large, didn't even leave a written record. But you can get a feel for the times by some of the letters and things that were written about them and people being quoted and people from the same strata, other sailors, and the way they would write letters or their testimony would be written down sometimes captures the feeling of their speech. Remember, this is 1715, 1718. We're sort of halfway between the English of Shakespeare and the English of Sherlock Holmes.
Right.
So it's a much more lyrical sounding language, with people talking in poem and idiom and a lot more it's a little bit alien to us today, but it has a sort of beautiful quality to it. Now, exactly what they sounded like, did they say "ar" and "shiver me timbers" and all those things? Well, they certainly would have had a whole maritime way of speaking. Mm-hmm. There seemed to be a language of the sea that people learned because when you went to foreign ports and oftentimes even outside the pirates, even on merchant vessels, you often had sailors of many nationalities serving. You'd usually – most of them would be from the country of origin, but you'd also have a lot of others who were picked up on the way to replace sailors who died, because so many did.
Yeah.
And and they developed a sort of patois language so that people could communicate sort of universally. And so there were a lot of seemed to be a lot of terms and ways of speaking that did that. So it probably would have been hard for non-sailors to totally understand everything that we're saying. Many of these pirates, as you pointed out, were of British origin,
right.
You know, certainly a plurality, and on many ships probably, you know, at least a bare majority, 50 or 60% probably were. That's largely because the piracy outbreak was happening in the Bahamas and drawing from people in Jamaica and the North American colonies, many of whom were of those origins. So it sort of explains where they came from. As to how would they have the R, it seems, may have been something that people in the West Country did in fact say. I mean,
yeah.
that way of talking that we pick up in pirate pop culture, the talk like a pirate day way of talking, you know, a lot of people tie that to some of the Hollywood movies that where Robert Newton was playing people
right.
like Blackbeard.
Yeah.
He spoke like that. But before that, pirates talked like Errol Flynn. You know, they were good gentlemen,
right.
And,
right. Right.
You know, with their swords and stuff.
Yeah.
And Robert Newton came from and grew up in the early 20th century in the West Country, as probably did Blackbeard and Sam Bellamy and many of the pirates. That was a stronghold of recruitment into the maritime trades. And it's entirely possible that the language, which he was apparently drawing from the language he remembered in his childhood and in Cornwall and Devon, may have been somewhat similar to the language that many of these pirates did in fact use. So
yeah.
There may be some basis to it.
The eye patches, the peg legs, that's we don't know for sure, but that seems plausible to you anyway, because ships were pretty dangerous places.
Oh, entirely. I mean, people were they had shifting cargo, rolling over people and crushing legs, and people have losing their eyes and hands and all sorts of things in accidents at sea. You know, it was a very dangerous occupation, and usually the medical treatment was amputation. So you would end up with an eye patch or a peg leg or a hook for a hand, and I think that was very prevalent throughout the merchant and naval vessels, and therefore the pirates as well. It was just common to being at sea.
Where did the parrot come from? That's got to be a Hollywood thing, does it? Or where did the parrot come from?
No, that's probably real as well, because sailors from, say, Scotland and England would arrive in a Caribbean port. And one of the novelties were these brightly colored birds that could serve as pets that you could purchase. And some of them could indeed be taught to talk, which was just so remarkable.
Yeah.
And many people bought them as curiosities and pets and accompaniments. And they would bring them back, you know, with them to England. And, you know, some of them would train them to be on their shoulders and stuff. So that seems well documented. And there are references, say, in court records to, you know, sailors being punished for stealing a tropical bird or, you know, herding the captain's bird. So it's clear that these birds were actually on vessels and were considered sort of prized souvenirs and maybe sort of companionship and entertainment on those long days at sea.
So I'm trying to figure if, in fact, pirates weren't as ruthless as we, you know, as they were supposed to have been, then walking the plank. I'm wondering where that came from in the first place, and is there any kernel of truth in that idea?
Well, it comes from Robert Louis Stevenson's
right.
novels.
Yeah, yeah.
So he kind of that's where we receive it from. In this gang of pirates, there's no documented instance of them ever having anybody walk a plank. It's a neat idea, but you know, you're more likely just if you were to get rid of somebody, grab them and throw them overboard. Why go through the bother of the plank unless you're trying to make them think that they're going to fall overboard. But we don't have any accounts of that. So in this article that I did for Smithsonian, there's some new discoveries that this was sort of an exclusive of Blackbeard's final days.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the new discoveries was that in his – we there were Mike Daniel, an underwater explorer, the man who discovered the wreck of Blackbeard's flagship back in the late 1990s, he discovered in French archives eyewitness accounts of the last capture Blackbeard made of two vessels. And when he captured the vessels, one of the things that the French victims, who eventually got back to France and filed these eyewitness accounts that he found, one of the things that they said is that Blackbeard threatened to throw them all into the sea if they didn't do what he asked.
Right.
And that's the closest reference we have. And indeed, you know, slaving vessels of the time. Remember, this is the height of the slave trade. They would, if they would run out of food or something because they would be waylaid, they would often throw their human cargo overboard. So there's this terrifying precedent of actually tossing people overboard in the middle of the ocean, which the pirates may have been keying off. So that would be my guess, is that Robert Louis Stevenson was drawing on that idea and embellished it somewhat.
Yeah. Do we have a sense of what life was like on the sea for a pirate? I mean, you mentioned the sort of miserable existence for merchant vessels, for example, how the food was literally sickening, the water was really terrible, which is where the idea of drinking rum came from. That was way better than the water, the alcohol. What was it like for a pirate on the sea? Do we have a sense?
When pirates were successful, they were doing all of the drunken debauchery, crazy parties, and, you know, getting themselves completely inebriated and doing foolish things and breaking stuff. That seems to be quite true. We have accounts from witnesses of these outlandish parties going on and them breaking into a cargo, you know, find a ship with a cargo of wine or rum and breaking into it by the barrel, and things quickly falling apart from there. So there seem to be these binging episodes that they would have. And then when they run out of all that stuff, they would the greatest danger was that they would end up having to fall back on the terrible conditions that ordinary sailors would have, where you'd have to start eating, you know, worm-infested ship's biscuits and water in casks, fresh water that had turned green and all that sort of thing. So the pirates were highly motivated not to have that happen. And oftentimes when they'd capture merchant vessels, they were often after, you know, the food and the water and the wine and stuff were among the things they most wanted. So part of the, you know, ambition of the pirates seemed to have been to live a merry life, even if it's a short one. They knew that their chances of long-term survival were poor, but they were going to try to have as good a time as they could until then. So there was a lot of hedonistic debauchery, I would say, going on the vessels. And then in times of privation, their lives would start resembling those of ordinary sailors more closely.
Yeah. Well, we know that treasure was true. I mean, that was a reality of pirate life. That's what they were after, the idea of treasure. But then the question of taking this treasure, putting it in a box and burying it somewhere, that doesn't make any sense to you.
But there aren't any accounts of the pirates going and burying their treasure in a box on some beach somewhere, and it never made a lot of sense to me either. I mean, why would you do that? Why would you go to a remote island and take all of these valuables and sink them on a beach and then leave when you have all these witnesses in your crew? Who knows what's going to happen next? And pirate ships are often, you know, you'd capture another vessel and your crew would split and you'd put a bunch of your crewmen on the other vessel and they would go out. It's almost metastasizing like a cancer, and the other ship would, you know, they would each grow bigger. So the chance that all of your fellow pirates who dug that hole in the sand are all going to be together as one group even a year from now is very small, and any one of them could go back and get that treasure. It just doesn't make any sense. It's incredibly insecure, and you have little guarantee of returning. What we do have evidence of is that many of these pirates built networks to fence their goods and acquire supplies. The pirates in the Bahamas at Nassau, where their base was, got the otherwise respectable merchants of a nearby island in the Bahamas, Harbor Island, to act as their go-betweens. The merchants would come down and buy all the stuff the pirates had gotten off the vessels they'd captured, you know, picking clean the boneyard of captured ghost vessels all stranded along the shores of Nassau Harbor. Mm-hmm. And they would sell all the stuff to these guys, and these guys would go take their orders and go up to Harbor Island and transship and head out to Charleston or Boston and pick up the rum and gunpowder and cannonballs and anything else the pirates had ordered, you know, cloth and finished tools and materials to fix their vessels and bring it back to them. So that was one way to get rid of your treasure. And if you had a lot of treasure, some pirates seem to have gone to certain established individuals who are known to act as sort of Swiss bankers for pirates, who would be willing to hold on to your treasure. There was one There's an island, if you look on a map at the end of Long Island, there's another island called Gardiner's Island. It's still there. Mm. And up until a decade or so ago, it had been held as a sort of feudal fief by the same family of gardeners for like 12 or 13 generations. And some of the early generations of gardeners appear to have fenced goods for William Kidd and Sam Bellamy. You know, these pirates would be heading along the seashore attacking vessels and suddenly would pull into Gardiner's Island and stay there for a few days and leave again. And when they left, there are no more accounts of the ship being filled with gold. So it seems that the gardeners were, in certain generations, were playing a key role in storing the pirates' goods for them and maybe acting sort of as bankers and investors for them. So that makes a lot more sense as to what to do with your treasure than to leave it stranded on some island.
Colin Woodard is with us. His book is called The Republic of Pirates. We'll take another break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with historian, journalist, writer Colin Woodard. We're talking about pirates. He has a book called The Republic of Pirates and an article in the February issue of Smithsonian Magazine called The Last Days of Blackbeard. Let's talk about Blackbeard. I guess he's the most famous pirate for most of us anyway. In your Smithsonian piece, you write that we're getting a little bit of new evidence about who he was. Edward Thatch is his name. Tell us about Edward Thatch.
Well, he was definitely a thinking man's pirate, and yeah. Of all the pirates in this group, he's one of the most impressive because you can see the chess games he was playing. We talked a little bit already about cultivating that image of terror so that he could get people to surrender without a fight, so he could get all the things he wanted without any risk. But he also, in where he chose to go and what he chose to do, he was often thinking several steps ahead of his adversaries. For instance, in 1718, the Pirate Republic in the Bahamas is facing a likely end. There's been a pardon issued by the king for any pirate who will give up. And if a pirate gives up, they can be absolved of all their past piracies and they can keep their loot. It's like a get-out-of-jail-free card. And it demonstrates how desperate the king was to divide the pirates before trying to conquer them. And this spelled sort of the end for the Bahamas because half the pirates were rushing out to get on their boats and go to the nearest colony to take a pardon from a governor. Mm-hmm. Now, Blackbeard, rather than wait until the bitter end, he ended up going, as we learn from documents that have recently been discovered and described in the magazine article, he went to try to get one last incredible prize. And he, as soon as he learned of the pardons, he heads to the Gulf of Mexico to try to catch an enormous and highly valuable merchant vessel that's the first English vessel to be trading with the Spanish Empire in decades, which is guarded by a Royal Navy frigate. And he plans to capture both of them. He doesn't succeed, but after attempting that, his next step isn't to return to the Bahamas to take the pardon, but he ends up going all the way up to North Carolina. Yeah. And first he takes his enormous frigate-sized warship and he runs it aground, perhaps accidentally, perhaps on purpose. But once it's aground, he uses this excuse to transfer his most loyal men and himself and the available treasure to a smaller vessel, and he abandons all of the all the pirates he doesn't trust, mm-hmm. the lesser sort, the ones that are giving him trouble on a sandbar, and he takes off and he goes north to this little village that's effectively the capital of North Carolina at the time. North Carolina in 1718 was this impoverished colony that had just been through an Indian war and had very few settlements of any size and was barely getting along. And Blackbeard showed up and he had all of these armed men and he had the means to bring all sorts of treasure to this impoverished colony. And he seems to have – he worked out a deal with the governor there who gave him a pardon and looked the other way as Blackbeard set himself up as sort of a mafioso figure, a Tony Soprano-like yeah. figure who could from a distance look like, hey, I'm just in the waste disposal business, right. but really was busy, you know, operating a piracy operation at sea. And the plan was to bring the vessels you captured at sea to some of the islands off the Outer Banks of North Carolina and take them apart and get all the treasure and then transship that treasure in smaller vessels up to this little village, Bath, North Carolina, that was the capital and sell it to the authorities claiming that you'd found it at sea or whatever. And the authorities right. would wink, you know. And that's what he did. And it's in, you know, he took a wife and was married there and from the outside appeared to be an ordinary citizen but was continuing to conduct his piracy. In other words, he'd worked out this whole plan mm-hmm. by which he could set up a second Nassau except one better than the original one because it had a legitimate governor who was guarding him and protecting him and in theory shouldn't be subject to any kind of outside intervention or invasion. Well, he was incorrect about that yeah. because some of his rivals were not so scrupulous about the law. But you can see what a strategic thinker he really was.
Yeah. Did he have a black beard?
He did. The one eyewitness description we have of what he looked like was a tall, lean man with a black beard, which he wore very long. So we know that that is true. And, of course, merchants and his victims from about 1716 onward were referring to him as Edward Thatch, alias Blackbeard. So he must have had a black beard to have gotten that nickname all of a sudden.
Talk about his end.
Well, he in the account in Smithsonian Magazine, you'll learn about his final capture, the sort of audacious attempt to and successful attempt to capture two much larger French vessels at sea and bring them back to the Outer Banks to dispose of them in the way I just described, to launder the money and so on and so forth. And he does that. Little does he know that as he's doing that and his men are celebrating their capture and he's delivering great parcels of valuable sugar to the to Bath and their barrels of it are finding themselves under a haystack in the official collector of customs barn. Little does he know that in the adjacent colony of Virginia, much more established, extremely wealthy, the governor there, Alexander Spotswood, is plotting a large and entirely illegal invasion of the colony. He gets together with the captains of the two Royal Navy warships posted in Virginia, and they hatch this scheme to do a two-pronged invasion to capture Blackbeard, an illegal invasion of a fellow colony. One group goes overland to Bath to surprise Blackbeard if he happens to be there, and the others take two small sloops and sail down the Outer Banks to see if they can't surprise Blackbeard at Ocracoke Island, where his dissembling of captured vessels operation took place. And the latter group found Blackbeard and his men at anchor off Ocracoke. They'd had a party the night before and were sleeping and didn't have a watch out and would have probably been captured right at anchor had the Royal Navy sloops not run aground entering the anchorage. And that gave Blackbeard time to get underway. And then there was this horrific set of battles and twists and turns, mm-hmm. which end with Blackbeard in a classic Hollywood sword fight with the dashing lieutenant, Royal Navy lieutenant, who's leading the Royal Navy detachment and a horrific battle in which Blackbeard finally falls. And his many of his men are killed and the rest are captured and his head is strung up on a bowsprit to be brought to Norfolk, Virginia and placed on a pole in what's now Blackbeard's Point.
Yeah.
So he meets his end in a Hollywood-quality naval battle aboard the decks of vessels.
Yeah, totally. I mean, that's a movie ending.
And it, you know, that's where those movies come from.
Right.
This account and much of the mythology we have all come from one book called The General History of the Pirates. It was published just a few years after Blackbeard's death and while some of these pirates were still alive. And that book is the basis of almost everything you think you know about pirates. Mm-hmm. Some of it absolutely true and based on official documents and some of it having been shown to be completely made up.
Right.
And there's other fascinating passages where historians don't yet know which it is.
Yeah.
So it's an intriguing and difficult to trust document.
Someone who wasn't a pirate, Woods Rogers, is a character you write about in your book. It seems like he was kind of the Elliot Ness of the era in the sense that he's kind of sent to confront the pirates, put an end to the age of piracy. He's kind of a forlorn character too, because he's this kind of celebrated figure, but then he kind of dies penniless. And this is the truth. I mean, you say that a lot of the men who fought the pirates fared worse in the end than the pirates themselves.
Yes, many did. And my book, the subtitles being The True and Surprising Story of the Caribbean Pirates and the Man Who Brought Them Down.
Yeah,
and that man was Woodes Rogers. And he had been the most famous privateer of that war that preceded the outbreak of piracy, the War of Spanish Secession. And he had actually built two privateering vessels. And instead of just going out into the English Channel and attacking some French merchant ships, he built two frigate-sized vessels and circumnavigated the world at a time when only a handful of people had ever done so, with the aim of attacking Spanish settlements in the Pacific and South America and Guam and elsewhere, and to capture one of these giant Manila galleons, these huge floating castles that annually carried the riches of the Spanish colonies in the Philippines and elsewhere back to Mexico for transshipment to Spain. And he did so. He captured one of these galleons. So he was an incredible hero. And he is the one who proposed to the king that there should be a pardon and that he should send – the king should send Woodes Rogers to try to pacify the Bahamas and conquer the pirates. And in return, what he asked the king is that he be made governor of the Bahamas. And the king says, go ahead. You know, bring your mercenaries. I will send a detachment of Royal Navy ships to guard you. But you know, it's pretty much up to you to do this. And Woodes Rogers is the man who goes and confronts the pirates in person and becomes governor of Nassau. And at the same time, there's a threat of renewed war with Spain and his situation's very vulnerable. And the pirates are starting to go back into piracy and he can't trust any of them. And all the mercenaries and men he's brought with him are getting sick because they're not acclimated to the tropical diseases there. And he himself is sick. And he ends up in an incredibly precarious situation. And the government in London isn't returning his phone calls basically or sending him any help, and he's spending his own money. And yeah, he gets himself into a very difficult circumstances. And he also seems to have had some personal personality quirks which led him to upset many of his the Royal Navy captains who came by, which led a lot of people to sort of conspire to bring him down. And they were rather successful in doing so. He gets replaced as governor and for a time is in fact penniless. So yes, confronting the pirates was often a difficult and dangerous task in and of itself.
So many great characters. Go read The Republic of Pirates, Being the True and Surprising Story of the Caribbean Pirates and the Man Who Brought Them Down. Or look at the Smithsonian Magazine article called The Last Days of Blackbeard, written by Colin Woodard. Our guest joined us from a studio in Portland, Maine. Colin Woodard, thank you very much for the time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.